Hey everybody, this is the Brothers Wisps number 50. We've made it. Now that we've got to 50, we can retire. We're done. Stick a fork in it. So today with us, we've got Thomas Kernak up at the top from Slovakia.
Hey everyone.
And then from all the way from Virginia, we've got Justin Miller.
Howdy.
Howdy. Excellent. So let's get some of the BS stuff out of the way really quick, and then we can move on to more kind of discussion topics as per the normal. Let's see. Mike found some Ubiquiti switch in the FCC. Apparently, it's got built-in wireless. I'm assuming that's maybe like a quick config tool. I think it was only like a small 2.4 gigahertz radio, so I can't imagine them trying to do anything real with it. What do you think?
It's actually a unify switch, so
is it
maybe a little combined device that's, you know, few Ethernet ports, wireless, all in one unify?
You think kind of like it's just a switch, so switch and wireless built in. All right, that'd be interesting. Let's see, swooping right along, UBNT finally announced their ONT, the Nano G. Miller, you said they had that at WISPA Palooza last year, right?
Yeah, it was one of those WISPAs. They had a special like room that you go and you get a t-shirt and go and tour it. And they actually had it out and stuff. But like a couple of shows ago.
Yeah, it looks cute.
They all kind of blur together for a while.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, it looks good. As far as OLT goes, I think, or rather ONT, because I know they already announced the OLT. That's already out. People have it. So this is the ONT, the user side of the GPON stuff. And it looks good. And
I think JJ was using it.
Yeah, I'm not. Yeah, and I noticed these things, they say they are supported by a couple of other manufacturers, so you can put it on somebody else's OLT. And in typical Ubiquiti fashion, they look pretty. They've got a nice little display, so... curious to see what people have to say about those. I haven't actually heard anybody say anything one way or the other. I'm interested. Let's see. Another note. Mike puts up a note. And this might be a little old, but the Cambium EPMP, apparently there's an exploit out. So if you've got some of that gear out in the field, you should probably look to update. Another note is Mike and company did a DNS video not too long ago. I'm not sure who was on that or... really what they covered other than DNS, but you guys should probably check that out. Let's move on to some interesting things. So recently we found out that Cambium Elevate is coming to MikroTik. I know they're working on it. I'm not sure how close they are to releasing that out into the wild. And so some of you may know, some of you may not, but Cambium has this Elevate program where you can put up a Cambium access point and then you can flash a special firmware, say on like a Ubiquiti device that allows it to communicate with the tower. I'm not sure if that's supposed to be a long-term solution or just kind of a temporary upgrade path. So, you know, you've got all of your clients switched over to your new tower gear and then you can kind of go and replace them at your leisure. But now they've got versions running for MikroTik as well. So you can flash MikroTik with the Elevate code and it can connect over to the Cambium access points, which I thought was pretty interesting for them to take on MikroTik. I guess it's not surprising they did it to Ubiquiti, not at MikroTik. And I'm not sure which platforms they've got the code for. I'm guessing maybe SXTs or something like that. What do you guys think? What are your opinions?
From what I remember, it was SXTs for now, but I might be wrong.
Most of those devices all use the BIPS B, whatever it is, same CPU, or is it B? It's that whole line, the 411s, 433s, and the SXTs, and the 711s, and Sextants.
All right. Do you know if Elevate's supposed to be a long-term solution, or is it just like a temporary migration path?
I don't know about that.
I think we talked about this on one of the previous casts, and the consensus seems to have been that, you know, changing the access point is fairly straightforward, but actually driving to every single client and changing the, you know, there is a non-negligible cost to actually migrating all of your CPEs and all of your clients. So this way, if you actually want to run EPMP Elevate code, it makes it just easier and faster and cheaper to migrate the client side.
It's interesting for sure. What's even more interesting is where we heard about it last. They were actually at the MUM in Denver. So it was kind of a ballsy move. I like that. moving right along, MikroTik in RC 6.40. I think it came out this week, right? Early this week?
Just a couple of days ago, actually.
Yeah. It changed up the bridging interface. And I know, Thomas, you've been plopping in some updates in the Slack about it every now and then, so you probably have more details on it. I think you've even started testing it a little bit. Would you like to fill us in a bit?
So I've actually heard about this first at the Italy MUM this year, that they first started talking about it, but that was still like, you know, don't really mention it to anyone, it's not ready yet, etc. And then this MUM, the US MUM, they said it will be out soon. And so now it is. I played with it a little bit. Of course, I haven't deployed it to production yet. And MikroTik themselves are saying this, you know, this is really, really early release, so that it can actually cause some problems. It might. So I started it up in GNS. I played a little bit with the config. So far, it looks actually fairly nice and readable. So what actually changed is normal bridges now automatically recognize if the bridge ports support hardware offloading, hardware acceleration, and if they do, they will just use that instead of software forwarding on layer 2. So MikroTik's goal in the long term is to completely remove the switch menu. So as everybody probably knows, a bunch of us complained how non-industry standard the MikroTik VLAN switch chip configuration is and everything. So this is actually supposed to replace that and make it much easier and much more, I would say, standardized or much more user-friendly, much more easier to configure VLANs and everything regarding to bridging. So how you do it with the new bridge implementation is you just create a bridge and then put ports into the bridge. If they are hardware offloaded, if they can be, you know, forwarded in the switch chip, they simply are. And actually, the bridge itself has some new configuration parameters, like frame types. If it should allow only tagged or untagged frames or all frames, you can configure a PVID on the bridge level. And then there is new support for MSTP, so multiple spanning tree protocol. And so really nothing changed in the way how we configure it, just there is a bunch of new options there which support the new features.
Well, the master port is gone now, right, under interfaces?
Yes, master port is completely gone.
Gotcha. So you don't have to fiddle with that
completely
anymore.
Completely yet, but...
Well, no. I mean, that's the long-term plan, right, is to get rid of the master port thing, which I think is... awesome.
Yes, finally. It's so good.
Yeah, it's a unified interface. So now you just get to do everything in bridges. If it's got hardware and it can support it, it'll crank it on. If it doesn't, it just does it in software. You don't have to try and figure it out or think about it. And it's unified configuration across all of the platforms, right?
So what is nice is that in bridge ports now, you can also configure like frame accepted frame types and PVID on the individual port level, or it can inherit from the bridge level. And then there is a new menu, which is interface bridge VLAN. And here you can actually define what VLANs live on which bridge, which are untagged on which ports, which are tagged on which ports, etc., etc. And it's just, for me, it's much more easily readable than the entire previous switch chip config. But so it doesn't do that much quite yet. I mean, there is there is MSTP experimental support, and there is this VLAN configuration and master port migration into the bridge menu. And one really nice new thing, which so many people have been asking, is IGMP. So actually, there is now an IGMP querier and just IGMP snooping support in bridges. It's completely experimental, CLI only, but it's there. And I know so many people have been asking for it. I'm personally very happy as well that it's, you know, you finally have IGMP in MikroTik.
Okay. So you just threw out a lot of stuff really fast. You talked about MST, the multi-spanning tree, right? So that gives you the ability to spin up multiple instances of spanning tree, and then you can put different VLANs in different instances. So it kind of allows you to, I guess, better control what VLANs are going to go over which trunk ports and things like that.
Normally, right, spanning tree blocks each redundant path, so it forms a coherent topology to blocking certain ports. Basically, it blocks everything that would create the loop, and then, of course, on certain, like, how the protocol works and on certain criteria, selects a single coherent topology throughout the network that's not looped. So why MSTP is good is that if you have, for example, 2 gigabit links connecting 2 switches, you would just block one link, so you lose half the throughput. Mm-hmm. With MSTP, you can actually say that different VLANs go through different links, and therefore you can actually get around the limitation of losing half the bandwidth in certain situations, right? Because the traffic from one VLAN will always have its separate spanning tree built, so it's not load balancing, really.
Right,
it's a little trick of how to...
Yeah, so it's not a guarantee of true bandwidth parity across multiple interfaces, but it gives you more control over what's going to run on what.
Yeah.
Excellent. Very cool. Let's see. You also talked about IGMP. Am I crazy, or is that like multicast group discovery?
So what they have right now is IGMP snooping, so yes, that's multicast, and it simply makes the switch properly forward multicast, so replicate the multicast streams instead of just broadcasting everything.
Perfecto. And then you talked about being able to set PVID on an interface. Tell us about that.
So how VLANs work, right, is that if there is an untagged frame received on an interface, it gets internally tagged with the PVID. So anything untagged coming in will actually be put inside of a VLAN, you could say, inside of the VLAN which the PVID is configured for the particular port. Or if there is no PVID configured in a port, it inherits from the bridge level.
Gotcha. So that'd be kind of like in a Cisco switch, the native VLAN, right? Running
yes,
over a port.
Exactly. Just like native VLAN in Cisco, except PVID is actually it's a little bit more flexible than native VLAN. And also it's the standard, like you configure PVID in Procurves, so in HP switching, in Convair, so old Freecom, or also now, you know, HP stuff. And it's a bit more standardized way of configuring VLANs across many vendors, whereas Cisco just does native VLAN.
All right, very cool. Very cool. I saw a thread somewhere. Somebody asked, "Hey, is anybody running the new .40 RCS?" I saw a couple of people saying that it broke their config. So hopefully you're not throwing it in production just yet. Maybe in a lab environment, kind of playing with it. I think somebody said it bricked their PPP configurations and some other. I can't remember. So just use it with caution, like any release candidate, right?
MikroTik specifically said that it's not, you can't actually downgrade. So when you upgrade to the new RC and you downgrade back, it will not replicate your old config. All your stuff will be unconfigured. So be careful. It's a very early build of the new bridging implementation.
That's interesting. So they must have, I mean, drastically changed a lot of things then.
So many things they must have changed in the background services in RouterOS. Yeah.
All right. Interesting. Anything else to say about that?
Just that I'm very happy it's finally here. And, yeah, good job, MikroTik. It looks good so far.
Yeah.
It looks very good. Now if they can actually like separate LLDP and MikroTik neighbor discovery, so that's aware also of physical and virtual interfaces, or you know, things like VLANs, etc. That would be good. And one thing which I haven't tested yet is how this all behaves with SNMP and how it breaks SNMP that you know, router OS exposes us. So since this is completely new implementation, it completely rewrites the spanning tree and the basically all the L2 logic of the MikroTik bridging. Yes, I can imagine, and I hope that now they will also expose proper things over SNMP, which were previously not. Like MikroTik exposes very little from the bridging MIP, exposes nothing from the STP or LLDP MIPs, which is all a shame. So I really hope they also, while they are fixing all of this, they also properly fix the SNMP support.
Cool. I guess that was your support ticket that you just verbally put in.
So many of them.
Please. Cool. All right. So I got a question from, I'm going to butcher his name, Alistair, the guy that was giving out shout outs last time. And he posed a question. He says, I currently use OSPF for our point-to-point connections between sites and IBGP for our routing. So regarding IBGP, we use route reflectors rather than a full BGP mesh. Should I be doing a full BGP mesh, or am I doing it right? Why would anyone do a full mesh? Why wouldn't everyone just use route reflection, or do they? I think that's a loaded question, right? So every network's a little bit different. There's no diagram associated with this, right? So there's no one-size-fits-all this. I think it's a good valid question, right? And I think you have to kind of start with what is IBGP, right? So IBGP is internal BGP, Border Gateway Protocol, right? It's a method of sharing routes. BGP still requires an IGP, right? Something to actually say, how do you get from interface to interface, which is why he's running OSPF. IBGP, the way it functions, all routers inside the same AS actually have to theoretically be fully meshed. If we have three routers in an IBGP and router one and two are paired together, and then router two and three are paired together, they won't show, or rather two and three won't share information they learned from one, because there's an assumption that they're all paired, right? So if you have three routers, they have to be fully meshed. They have to all be paired with each other because, you know, the assumption is there that they're all paired. So I think that's scalable. In a small network, you know, you have four or five routers, you can do that, right? That's going to be, if you have five routers, each one's going to have four peering sessions on there. So multiply that by five devices. That's, was that 20 configurations? How does that scale though? Once you get up to 10, you know, you're looking at 90 configs. And then once you get to 100, you know, I mean, you see how it gets kind of astronomically, out of hand, as well as, every time you have a peering, it adds additional CPU and memory requirements on those routers. So something people can do is use what he mentioned here as route reflectors. And so route reflectors kind of break those IBGP rules. So if you send something to a route reflector, it can actually reflect that IBGP information to other users. Now, this is hard to explain without a diagram, but it allows a route reflector can kind of break that full mesh rule. So if you have two routers paired with a route reflector and then a third peers with a route reflector, they can that third one can learn the IBGP information from those first two without having to actually peer with them. They're getting it all from the route reflector, and vice versa. He'll take the third router's routes and then he'll advertise them out to the other. So it makes it a little bit more scalable. The guys on the end don't have to have as many peering sessions, right? So it doesn't tax them as hard, saves CPU resources, saves memory, but the route reflectors on the other hand have to maintain all those peering relationships, so they've got to be beefier routers. I feel like route reflectors, especially as your network grows, is definitely the way to go, at least in my experience doing this stuff. Why would you do a full mesh? I know my backbone routers, I fully mesh those guys, but then at a site I'll have route reflectors and I'll let everything downstream from there kind of follow that route reflector rule, and then when it hits the backbone, those guys will full mesh back to each other. That's generally how I do it. How about you guys and your experiences? Are you using route reflectors? Do you differ in those statements, right? There's other more complicated things you can do, like confederations, but I don't see a whole lot of people using those, where it sort of confederation logically breaks up your network into these different chunks that treat each other like they are their own autonomous systems, and that just gets
like
more complicated.
Like a north and a south.
Yeah, yeah. They start treating each other like they're external peers. So it just gets a lot hairier. I guess BGP is not something that's easy to just talk about as opposed to show pictures. I think in pictures, so I need to see those pictures. But what do you guys think? You using route reflectors in your networks?
Yeah, I use route reflectors. I run Bind. Not Bind, Bird.
Cool. So are your...
One thing that the direct peering could actually be useful, for example, is distribution of VPLS tunnels through BGP. In those cases, you usually want to peer between the BGP peers directly. So okay. Depending on how many VPLS endpoints you terminate and where, that can actually bring up your direct neighborships between those BGP peers.
I'm not running heavy MPLS inside my infrastructure. I'm just mostly doing internet routes and floating that stuff around.
BGP can be used for many things, right? As we all know, it's a huge protocol that can do so many things and it can get so complicated. But yeah, you can distribute VPLS over BGP. You can distribute MPLS traffic engineering endpoints over BGP as well to basically form dynamic VPLS tunnels or dynamic MPLS TE tunnels. And so yeah, that can be a reason why you would actually want to have direct BGP peering between two routers other than just using a route reflector.
So you're saying in a very large organization, route reflector won't additionally send MPLS information?
So it depends on what you want to do, right? You can, of course, like route reflectors are route reflectors, it will work, but it depends. It's like you said in the beginning, this is a very complex topic and every single network is different. And there is place for direct BGP peering as well as there is place for route reflector. Or route reflecting, right? And I think like the majority of the people will of course run route reflectors because it's just not scalable configuring every single peering directory between routers. Also, the problem is in large organizations where you actually have proper change management processes and where you have like auditing and approval of changes before they are pushed to your devices. Bringing on a new router and deploying it, and that requiring reconfiguration of every single other device in your network, that's just not doable from even just the change tracking and change management standpoint, right? So yes, route reflector is definitely the way to do it, but still direct peering still has its places in certain use cases.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you raise another point. Every time you have to touch another router, you open up the chance for human error, right? You could make a mistake configuring that device. That always worries me. I try not to manipulate my backbones very often, right? And obviously I do those in Windows, but I think it's sort of a route reflector will sort of limit the sphere of potential damage you have. Well, I don't know. I could do some damage. Bring up any router. I like to change as few things as possible. So in a maintenance window, sometimes I'll stagger them out, right? I'll change a small portion here and then I'll wait a week and then I'll change a little bit more, to kind of phase in things. If you change 10 things at once, how do you know which one is the one that's broken, that's causing problems? Whereas, if you just break that 10 into three changes and four, you can usually quickly divine where your problem lies and get to the resolution a little bit quicker. I'm very paranoid like that in most of my networks. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah, it's a lot about containment, right? You want to contain that change set. You want to contain the complexity of the change that you are deploying. And touching one instead of touching everything, it's a huge difference, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, that's me talking about like a big service provider network. If I was a WISP, you know, and it was all in my network, I'd probably be a little bit more cavalier about it. But I have a lot of SLAs with a lot of people, so I'm just very paranoid when it comes to that stuff. Let's see. You know what? Something that just popped in my head, and I know this is completely off topic, but I'm going to ask you anyway, because it's been like sort of kicking around in my brain. I was wondering, does Unimus have the ability to do backups over Raman, right? And so Raman's the ability you can connect to, say, a border router, and then through the Raman protocol, you can get to other devices inside, even via Winbox, without even having an IP address put on those devices. Is there a way that Unimus can connect to that border router and back up other devices? Is that something you thought about?
So sadly, Winbox, the protocol and ROMOD, it's all completely proprietary. And it's also all encrypted and secured.
Couldn't you SSH in and then use the Roman tools menu to get from one to another?
You could, theoretically, like sure. There is, like, you can do many different funny things, right? But
so there is a path.
Sure, there is always some path. But the thing is, you know, how you would configure this, how it would be nice and easily configurable. And I mean, sure, there is a way to do anything and everything somehow, right?
I was going to say, that's not my problem. You're the one writing the software. Not. You got to make that happen.
Heard it here first. It's in the next version, right?
I was just thinking how convenient that would be, because I have almost like MSP-ish networks, you know, where I've got one border router that I control, and then I've got a few access points inside there, and it'd just be really nice if I could just, you know, but so I use Raman, so it'd be super convenient.
I actually have a different solution which might be better, because Raman is MikroTik only, etc. But what we actually, it's not something that we do currently, but what we want to do, it's already on the roadmap, is actually support SOX proxies. And you can run a SOX proxy on a MikroTik as well. And through a SOX proxy, you can suddenly actually reach anything, whether it's a MikroTik or a different vendor, or, you know, so it's actually a more universal way of supporting these true SOX proxies. And that is already on our roadmap.
I'm sorry, I'm just making notes.
It seems like the SSH portion that you can specify remote ports in it, like what's it, reverse, drawn a blank.
You can use SSH port forwarding as well.
Yeah, you can do that, and you can actually specify a different IP address that's not the device that you're on.
There right. are multiple options, definitely.
So just port forward
SSH
all the devices.
Port forwarding. You can use SOX proxying, you can use theoretically Roman, yeah. And another thing is, what we want to do is actually have our own, like, deployable, very little, very lightweight, we call it Unimus Core. And so you could actually have multiple cores, which are just very little applications that run on whatever, and those cores would do the proxying or would back up the things locally, and then it send it to a central server. So that's also one of the things that we played. It would be like remote proxying agents or something like that.
So do you imagine that being like a Raspberry Pi or just a little VM or something?
Oh yeah, whatever. Really, it wouldn't really do anything other than serve the purpose of like forwarding and proxying the SSH connections, or not just SSH, because we support Telnet, and of course we actually are working on HTTP and HTTPS support as well for things which don't do SSH or Telnet, right? So what we want to have is something universal. So that's why I'm saying that Roman is probably not the best choice, because it's first of all MikroTik only, and second of all it's, you know, SSH. Well, it's not even SSH, right? Because it's Roman, it's the MikroTik proprietary protocol, but it's CLI. You know, it's command line interface. So you wouldn't be able to, for example, forward HTTP or HTTPS requests over it. And that's like the same issue with SSH port tunneling as well, or SSH port forwarding, that it's SSH only, right? And of course,
you can forward on the other side
to whatever, yeah. But you have to have SSH accessible on that one device through which you tunnel.
Yeah.
And so currently we are thinking about SOX proxying. So SOX can proxy anything and it can run on anything. Even a MikroTik can be a SOX proxy. And we are thinking about like the little remote agents or proxies that the advantage there is that even with SSH tunneling or with SOX proxies, you have to have something that's on a public static address that you would be able to connect to and proxy through. So that's another downside, right? If you have a little remote proxy core, what we currently call Unimus core, it would actually connect to your server instead of you having connect to it. So there, you know, you could have it in networks behind NAT and all of that. So there is a lot of considerations. There is a lot of you know, things that we are thinking about, and we haven't decided 100% yet on what we will do, but it is on the roadmap, and we will actually start working on it sometimes in Q3 this year.
Nice. Aren't we getting close to the Unimus launch?
Next week, actually.
I would say that's close.
Yeah, that's close. We actually made the call this week. Originally, we had a bit of a different plan because we have currently in implementation some very requested UI features like multi or cross-device diff. So you can actually diff configs between two devices and other nice things that people requested. But we decided that the current code base is really stable and working really well, and we've got it deployed in many places and everybody's happy with it. So instead of introducing new features and new GUI things that could potentially contain issues, we will just release what we have right now. So next week we are officially releasing stable, production ready, well-tested Unimus V1. And then probably in another 2 or 3 weeks, we will have the new cross-device diff and the GUI features and other things ready with another different release.
Very cool. You look excited.
Oh, it's finally. We are very happy that, you know, yeah, it's finally happening.
Very nice. Very nice. So something else that was super random that I woke up thinking about the other day. And this is super off topic, and I don't know why I was thinking about it, but I was. It's one of those things where you're trying to go to sleep and something just kind of keeps kicking around in there. I was thinking about ICMP, you know, how pretty much anywhere you go that's allowed through, you know, you can get through a firewall with ICMP. And I was thinking, you know, whenever you send a ping packet out to somebody, it usually replies and is allowed to go through a NATA device, right? So if I've got a private IP and I can't, you know, theoretically I can't initiate sessions from the outside coming in, I can still send out a ping and it's allowed to return. Why couldn't I, you know, because like in the body of an ICMP package, depending on how big it is, it's just the alphabet over and over and over in there. Why couldn't you write a program that would sit on my client machine and then I'd have one listening on a server somewhere that I would initiate a ping to, it just a continuous ping. And I could type in a message and it would just go in the body, and then the client application at the far side at the public IP could receive that message, and then they could type something back and put that in the reply. And so you could actually have two-way communication with that. And I was thinking, could you, if you had, say, 1450 byte packets with ICMP, could you go to like a hotel, you know, where they block everything else, but they usually let ping out? Or I've seen at least most of the time, the ones over here, the hotels will let pings out so that, you know, your little exclamation point doesn't show up in your wireless device when you connect. They'll just hijack pretty much everything else. But a lot of times they'll let pings through. Could you write a program where you could stream like video using ICMP?
You basically want tunnel over ICMP.
Yeah.
GRE over ICMP.
But when you're at the hotel, you don't care about doing work. You just want to watch Netflix, right? So could you could you figure out, like, would you be able to, I don't know, right? So it's like a firewall should theoretically throttle how much ICMP you do, although I don't think most people are clever enough to really put that in. So you could probably send pings pretty damn fast with 1450 byte packets. So could you actually watch a Netflix feed if you made some kind of crazy proxy thing in there to do all the communication with ICMP messages? You think that's possible, Mr. Programmer?
Did you Google this for an answer first?
No.
So that's,
I want to. Sometimes I like the thought experiment
for this.
Is there really?
You would be surprised to what lengths people go to get over blocking and firewalls. What? So, yeah, there is all kinds of tunneling. You can do ICMP tunneling. You can do DNS tunneling.
Yeah,
because many
I've seen
times,
DNS stuff.
You know, they don't block DNS either. So you can actually do tunneling over DNS UDP. There is so many things.
Yeah, I've seen exploits using DNS, which were pretty trippy, with like DNS request and response, where they would actually send... files, the contents of files that would just kind of crunch through them and send them piece by piece over DNS. I was thinking you could probably do command and control with ICMP as well. You know, in this way, you send a persistent ping and to a control server and just say, what do you want me to do? And then reply, you know, in the ICMP message and have it connect and do something. I think you could probably get away with that.
In the ICMP protocol, there is many more things than just ping, right? You have arbitrary message delivery and ICMP hello functionality and everything. Yeah, ICMP is actually a big protocol that, considering how basic and how important of a protocol it is, many people actually don't know everything it can do and everything that it contains. But yeah, there is software out there for ICMP tunneling. Yeah,
I'll use about 10% of the functionality.
Yeah,
just kind of reach something.
Specifically in IPv6, ICMPv6 is so huge; it can do many things. And
yeah, but that's a protocol that's run on your computer. I'm talking like people actually interacting with ICMP. That's all they really do is ping, route. That's pretty much it.
Yes, physically manipulating things. Yeah, yeah. You know, I remember what kicked it off is I was troubleshooting a customer's problems. And they had, I think, 4 remote sites from the data center that they were having issues reaching. They were supposedly having routing problems to these different ones. And so trying to test was impossible because they were filtering ICMP, every bit of ICMP off of each one of them. And it just, I don't know, it just made me want to die a little bit. You know, it's like everything that's wrong with the world. When you filter, you know, because it's, as a network engineer, I'd like to think we have a toolbox with a lot of things in there, but when it comes right down to it, you know, ping is pretty much the main thing we have, you know, because I can't control the internet, I can't control what other ISPs are doing, so the only thing I can really do for path determination, at least unidirectionally, and is this thing alive, is ICMP. And if I do think it's a problem in a carrier network, and I'm trying to prove it to them, what's the only thing they're going to do? They're going to ping and trace route to these test subjects, right? So I can argue my case all day, but if I can't prove it, you know, then they're not guilty, you know, because they're innocent until proven guilty. So if you're filtering things, you're hamstringing every network admin, you know, as responsive as I like to think I am and as dedicated, you know, like I like to jump on things really quick and really just focus on these, you know, customer related issues and really handle them. God, they make it difficult when they do that. And there's only a handful of people that I've run into that do that. And it drives me crazy. I'll link that, you know, should I block ICMP article or whatever. It comes back to that again. I don't want to beat this dead horse, but man, it was like, I don't know, 2.5 hours of troubleshooting to ultimately find out it wasn't our problem, but it took that long because of the filtering problem. You know, it's like, well, is it a routing problem or is it that they're filtering it? You know, and it's just having to test from all of these disparate locations and do correlations as best you can. And I don't know, stuff drives me crazy. Do you guys run into that a lot?
I just ran into that this week. We did some maintenance and moved some stuff over to an Nutanix, and we forgot to move a static route that we were redistributing for some additional public IPs at a business. And of course the business has a SONIC wall in their block and pings, and they call us up and they're like, we're down. We're like, well, we can't really tell because, you know, you're dropping pings. So
Yeah. And also, great. Like, if somebody reports they're having problems, I'll add them to my internal and external monitoring, and I'll leave them there for a month or two, you know? Because I take this stuff seriously, you know? But if you're blocking one of my main troubleshooting paths, you know, you're just... It's like I can't even provide these additional free services for you. It's just crazy. Yeah. Drives me crazy. I'm going to get off my high horse on blocking ping. Anybody listening to this knows better than to block ping.
Yeah, there's two things to this, right? Monitoring is a big one. Like, just about any packet loss detection or uptime detection software and service would be reduced. Yeah, it's ICMP. But what I want to add is, you said by blocking ICMP you will make every network's admin day a bad day. But it's not just that. Blocking ICMP, you block path MTU discovery.
Yeah, path discovery.
And that will screw over your users, not the networking admins. So you will actually screw over your users because path MTU discovery will not work, which is just bad. So you would have to do some MSS adjustments or other things, and it's just bad as well because of performance things and messing with MSS.
I think that to that point, like, it's whether or not you're blocking it on the forward chain or the input chain in the firewall. You know, so path MTU discovery will work if you're only blocking it on input on the firewall, like edge of the network.
But,
things can come through, and path MTU still works. It's just like a lot of people just block it on their firewall that's doing all the NAT and everything to hide themselves from attack or whatever.
If you block it on input, you usually block it from your local network as well. You might not, but you might. And if you block it from your local network on input, that will break path MTU discovery.
Interesting.
If there is outgoing or ingoing connections from the outside to some services in, that will break it as well. But yes, I completely get what you're getting at.
So here's another one for you guys. So recently, I got a multimode connection hooked up for me, and it's OM1 multimode that's been in the dirt for, I don't know, 20 years. So it is ancient multimode fiber. I have no idea what the distance is, but I know standard single mode optics don't come up on a 1 gig connection. I don't think you have like extended long range multimode optics, do you? If I drop down to a 100 meg multimode interface, is that going to work better? I mean, I don't think so, because it's going to have the same amount of light, right? So it's still gonna need something.
You could probably get those multimode optics custom made with additional error correction overhead. So like when you buy a 10 gig optic, it's actually 10.3 gigs because there's like 300 megs of 300 gigs of 300 megs of error correction that it can, or loss that it can have and still maintain the connection. So if you try and look for multimode optics to do that, probably.
So something I tried for funsies was mode conditioning patch cables, where they allow you to do like dispersion correction so you can run single mode optics over multimode. I did a bunch of Googling and I couldn't figure out what's the distance limitation of this technology. And so I tried it with just some 10 kilometer optics because the patch cables are like $5 a piece. I thought, why not, just for fun, see what happens? Because I've always wanted to try them. And it would not come up either. Actually, just looking at pure light levels, I get more out of the multi-mode than I do out of the single mode. So I think this is just too old, and it's probably going through too many patches for mode conditioning to work on a single mode optic.
It's not the amount of light that changes with your higher distance optics. It's the receive sensitivity of the receive side. So no. All the lasers are all the same power. It's the receive side that's more...
You say that if you look at the specs on different long range optics, they actually say their output power is higher.
Well, some will have a different range of output power, but the main difference is the receive sensitivity.
Yeah. Because I mean, it didn't look like the output power was a huge improvement, like a great tremendous amount, but it was bigger.
Yeah.
And every guy will tell you every little bit counts. Every inch matters. I'm just going to have to try and find some kind of something on the multi-mode side. So I think there's a way. I think it's probably pretty close.
There's a really great Nanog presentation on fiber and optics and all that stuff. Like, he gets really deep into all that kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So. There's probably not a whole lot of people that are trying to use ancient, crappy multi-mode fiber to do long-range shots. I just don't think that's happening. Because this, I actually have no idea how far this is, but it's going to be several fiber miles. It's probably like 4 or 5 fiber miles, maybe less. I don't know. Somewhere, it's probably at least 2. It's probably between 2 and 6, somewhere in that neighborhood. So it's not a short shot. This was, a university was putting in fiber, and they thought, we'll just put multimode everywhere. We could do everything we'll ever need off of this stuff, and it's unfortunate. They've since, like in the last 15 years, switched most of their stuff to single mode, but all they could get me at this site was multi-mode, so it is what it is. I thought maybe you guys would have some kind of silver bullet for me. Oh, well. You guys have anything else? Because I am completely out of thoughts at this point. The blank stare says it all. All right, let's put a bow on it.
The silence speaks.
All right. Thomas Kernack, if people want to reach you in the real world, or rather, I guess on the internet, that's kind of like the real world, how would you like them to do that?
Yeah, I'm pretty easy to find. Just Google for me, Facebook, all the social networks, basically email, unimus.net, and I'm easy to find.
Excellent. Justin Miller, if you by chance wanted people to find you in real life.
Unstatic.net, UINSTATIC.net.
Sweet action. And again, I have to compliment you for that awesome poster right up there in the back.
I mean, this one.
That one, yeah. You guys probably can't tell, but it's a Rick and Morty poster.
Oh, I can do the extreme close-up on it.
Have they released the second or third episode yet?
July 30th.
Oh, man, that's forever.
July 30th.
There. Sweet action. All right, if you guys want to reach me, I'm gregsoul.com. You can find me there and contact me. I very occasionally put out blog posts as well. Let's see. If you want to ask any questions, leave any comments, you can hit us the old school way via email at contactus@thebrotherswist.com, or better and snappier results will come through Facebook. That's facebook.com/thebrotherswisp. All of these little news tidbits that pop up and get answered really quick, that's all Mike Hammett. So big thanks to him. He's Johnny on the spot with all that stuff. Any questions, comments, please keep them coming. And if nothing else, we've got 50 down. I guess we'll see you for the next 50. Thanks, guys. Bye.